Iran's president says there should be a distinction between protests and rioting and that people's security is a red line for the Islamic Republic. Iran categorically rejects the UAE's claims over three Persian Gulf islands, stressing that they are an inseparable part of the country. Also ahead, the US says it is doubling the number of HIMARS rocket systems delivered to Ukraine as part of Washington's new military aid package for Kiev. Welcome to World News from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says the recent rioting in the country is another flip side of the sanctions that the West has imposed on Tehran. And this after the country witnessed the riots and chaos for a fortnight following the death of a young woman in the capital, Tehran.
Today we consider sanctions and rioting as two sides of the same coin. We also consider hypocrisy and rioting as two sides of the same coin. It is not acceptable that some people want to spread riots in the country. They are the same people who are using Ms. Amini's death as a pretext. Her case is being followed up and investigated. We are fully responsible for that.
Raisi was speaking in a televised address to the nation. He said there should be a distinction between peaceful protests and rioting. The Iranian president added that people's lives and security are the Islamic Republic's red line. The president noted that the enemy is seeking to divide the Iranian people, but the Islamic Republic will not allow that to happen. Raisi stressed that the government is seeking transparency and justice regarding the young woman's death. In another part of the interview, Raisi touched on the negotiations held to revive the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
Iran has put forward three major points in its latest proposed text. One is a strong guarantees that must be given to Tehran. The issue of safeguards, which has to be resolved, has been also highlighted in Iran's text. And finally, the removal of sanctions. The removal of sanctions must be permanent so that Iranian people would enjoy its economic benefits.
Raisi said the United States has admitted that its maximum pressure policy against Iran has failed. He added that Tehran has made great progress despite sanctions and pressure. The Iranian president said Tehran expects the International Atomic Energy Agency to refrain from politicizing issues related to Iran's nuclear program. He said 15 back-to-back reports by the IAEA have proved that Tehran's nuclear program is totally peaceful. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has once again pounded bases of anti-Iran terrorist groups located in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The IRGC says 73 surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and tens of combat drones have hit the terrorist bases, leading to the complete destruction of the designated targets. The IRGC has been conducting raids on positions of the terrorist hideouts in the Kurdistan region since September the 24th. It says it had urged Iraqi Kurdish officials to wipe out the presence of those terrorist outfits. But according to the IRGC, the Kurdistan regional government brushed aside its warnings and failed to adopt an appropriate measure. The IRGC says terrorists in northern Iraq have recently infiltrated Iran's border and attacked a number of outposts. The terrorists in northern Iraq are reported to have capitalized on protests over the death of an Iranian woman in police custody and largely involved in inciting riots across Iran. Staying with Iran, where the country has once again categorically rejected the United Arab Emirates' claims over three Persian Gulf islands, stressing that they are an inseparable part of the country. In an address to the UN General Assembly, Iran's mission rejected Abu Dhabi's allegations as baseless and irresponsible. It's added that UAE's claims also amounted to interference in Iran's internal affairs while violating the basic principles of international law. The mission added that territorial integrity of Iran and its sovereignty over the three Persian Gulf islands are not open to negotiation. The reaction came after an Emirati minister repeated her country's claims over the three Iranian islands of Abu Musa, Lesser Tamb, and Greater Tamb. Iran has always said the trio are an indispensable part of the country, the proof of which can be corroborated by countless historical, legal, and geographical documents. And Iran has warned about the re-emergence of terrorist groups in Afghanistan, describing it as a serious threat to the country's neighbors, as well as the region and the world. The remark was made by Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN in an address to the Security Council. Zahra Irshadi said Afghanistan must not turn into a safe haven for such terrorist groups such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda. She added that international community must continue to send aid to Afghanistan. Irshadi noted that sanctions imposed on certain persons and institutions in Afghanistan must not hamper humanitarian cooperation with the country. She also urged the Taliban government to heed its international obligations and pave the way for the establishment of an inclusive government representing all ethnic groups. A new report by the World Bank says that Afghanistan is facing rising inflation generated by global food and energy prices and the impacts of ongoing severe drought which has affected the country. Rahmatullah Baghban has a report from Kabul.
The World Bank, in its latest report on Afghanistan, has said that global food and energy prices continue to put pressure on basic household prices in the crisis-stricken country. At the same time, rising inflation and slow recovery in nominal wages have decreased the people's ability to buy basic goods.
Today, we witness people have lesser purchasing power. Previously, a middle-class household used to pay nearly $200 to buy multiple goods, but today they only ask for very basic necessities like oil and flour. You know, the prices are increasing. In addition, the banking crisis and sanctions have affected the prices and business in the market.
The World Bank report has confirmed that since June 2022, Afghanistan's currency has depreciated slightly against the US dollar, while the prices of basic food and fuel items continue the upward trend. Abdullah Rizayi, who has been working as a shoemaker for almost half of his life, says he had never experienced such economic conditions before.
In the past years, I used to make sufficient income from this job. Currently, I'm not only receiving fewer customers, but the money that I earn has lost its value. I used to make 300 Afghanis per day, but nowadays I hardly can make 50, which is the price of 5 loaves of bread. Sometimes I feel ashamed when I look at my children.
In the meantime, widespread joblessness is leaving many Afghan families without a solution to make ends meet.
We have had a job once or twice a week in the spring and summer. I wonder why we should do it in the winter when there is no job today. People are struggling with hunger and difficulties. Some have their own houses, but they should pay for the house rent too. This year, I fell short of paying the bills, and now I am in debt.
This comes as the World Food Program has warned that Afghanistan is facing its most serious risk of famine in 20 years. The UN body has asked for $1.1 billion life-saving assistance for 18 million people across Afghanistan. The ripple effects of the US sanctions and freezing of billions of dollars in Afghans' assets are pushing up inflation in Afghanistan. People here are calling for the release of assets and more international funding to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Palestinian resistance factions have strongly condemned Israel's deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, warning of retaliation. The leader of the Islamic Jihad movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, has vowed to respond to the Israeli crimes, stressing the movement won't stay idle. Earlier, Hamas warned that Israel would pay the price of its crimes. A Hamas spokesman said the killings will not deter Palestinians from their path of resistance until Palestine is fully liberated. Meanwhile, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh decried the killings, saying Tel Aviv will be responsible for the repercussions of its, quote, gruesome crime. Earlier in the day, four Palestinians were killed and dozens injured after Israeli forces stormed the refugee camp and violently clashed with people protesting the raid. Armenia says three soldiers have been killed by shelling from Azerbaijan in the latest round of border clashes between the two neighbors. Azerbaijan's defense ministry, however, gave an opposing account. It said one of its servicemen was first wounded in cross-border firing by Armenia, prompting retaliatory measures from the Azeri side. Both sides accuse each other of violating an existing truce. The latest round of fighting comes weeks after the neighbors engaged in two-day border clashes that killed almost 200 soldiers. The fighting is linked to decades-old hostilities over control of the mountainous Nagorno-Karabakh region. It is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but was populated and largely administered by ethnic Armenians until 2020. More than 7 months into the Ukraine war, the United States says it is doubling the number of HIMARS rocket systems given to Kiev as part of a new military aid package. The 18 additional multiple rocket systems with pinpoint accuracy will be sent over the medium and long terms. 16 HIMARS rocket systems have been so far deployed by Ukraine in its counter-offensive against Russia. The new military aid package, worth over $1 billion, also includes armored vehicles, tactical vehicles, trucks and trailers. The new package takes the total U.S. military aid to Ukraine to $16.2 billion since the war began in late February. Tensions are ratcheting up between Turkey and Greece once again over two Aegean islands of the Turkish coast. Ankara is accusing Athens of ignoring the non-military status of the two islands of Lesbos and Samos. But a quick history check shows that Greece and Turkey, which are both part of the US-led NATO alliance, have a long-standing feud over maritime borders and energy exploration rights in the Aegean and East Mediterranean seas.
Tensions between Greece and Turkey in the Aegean Sea are at boiling point, with Ankara summoning the Greek ambassador over alleged provocations in the region, where the two sides have been at odds over the status of the Greek islands. Turkey has accused Greece of deploying US-made armored vehicles on the two islands of Lesbos and Samos. Ankara says this is in violation of international law and is calling on Athens to respect the formerly agreed non-military status of the area. Lesbos and Samos used to be part of the Ottoman Empire, but Istanbul's grip on them dwindled by the start of the 20th century. Greece incorporated the islands along with several others in the early 1910s. Athens sealed its sovereignty over them under the 1923 Treaty of Lausanne, which ended Turkey's hostilities with European nations. This agreement's terms specifically banned Greece from building naval bases or fortifications on four of them, including Lesbos and Samos. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan warned that Turkey wouldn't hold back on defending its rights, accusing Athens of playing perilous games. The Turkish government has also sent a protest note to the US saying American weapons should not be used in breach of the island's agreed status.
That's after Ankara shared recorded aerial images showing ships loaded with U.S.-made military equipment docking at the islands. In response, Greece has rejected Turkish accusations as unfounded. The two nations are at odds over a slew of issues, including commercial rights in the Aegean and territorial waters in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. Turkey and Greece have competing ambitions over gas reserves, and they disagree profoundly over who has rights to key areas of the eastern Mediterranean. They have laid claim to overlapping areas, arguing they belong to their respective continental shelves. Tensions between the two countries flared in 2020 over exploratory drilling rights in areas of the Mediterranean Sea, leading to a naval standoff.
In recent years, huge gas reserves have been found in the waters off Cyprus, prompting the Cypriot governments, Greece, Israel, and Egypt to work together to make the most of the resources. As part of that agreement, energy supplies would go to Europe via a 2,000-kilometer pipeline in the Mediterranean. Tensions between Turkey and Greece show that Ankara doesn't want to be excluded from the energy equation in the region.
Turkey and Greece have been at odds over issues ranging from overflights and the status of Aegean islands to maritime boundaries and hydrocarbon resources in the Mediterranean, as well as ethnically split Cyprus. Ankara is using the crises to try to sideline and isolate Athens, as Turkey also wants to play the energy card amid the Ukraine-Russia war. In fact, Turkey has sought to improve relations with Israel specifically to reroute energy deals from Israel via Turkey to Europe. The goal is to isolate and sideline Greece and then make the European Union and NATO members dependent on Turkey. The Greek-Turkey crisis, therefore, is not just about a few incidents in the Mediterranean. Turkey's own media is saying this is part of the geopolitical plan by Ankara to realign with Moscow and work on Syria. This could result in new destabilization in the eastern Mediterranean, affect Turkey-Israel ties, and unleash militants backed by Turkey in Syria. On the other hand, a recent article at TRT claimed experts believe Greece's increasing violations of Turkish airspace is part of an agenda encouraged by the West to corner Turkey for taking an independent foreign policy in the eastern Mediterranean region.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
European households are these days bombarded by bad economic news, whether in their own country or the continent as a whole. New reports show that the Eurozone's economic downturn has deepened in September, with business activity contracting for a third consecutive month. If the EU would survive the bad economic situation is a big question, and its answer doesn't seem to be very optimistic as the Europe sources are ending. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Please stay tuned. According to Bloomberg, private sector activity in the Eurozone contracted for a third month as record inflation erodes demand and forced some firms to limit production. Barring months where there were lockdowns, an index of purchasing managers compiled by S&P Global slumped to its lowest level since 2013. The downturn accelerated in manufacturing and services, with new orders falling and the outlook bleak. The Eurozone's economic downturn deepened in September with business activity contracting for a third consecutive month, a new survey by S&P Global showed. The report found that manufacturers across the 19-country union were hit hard by skyrocketing energy costs, with the Purchasing Managers Index PMI sinking to its lowest level since 2013. The PMI, which is seen as a good gauge of overall economic health, fell from 48.9 in August to 48.2 in September. Surging energy prices and the rising cost of living are not only hitting demand but also limiting manufacturing production and service sector activity in some cases, according to Bloomberg. The website of RT wrote, 1 in 6 elderly Germans are at risk of poverty. A growing number of citizens over the age of 65 have less than 60% of the median income, Funke Media Group found. Around 1 in 6 Germans over the age of 65 is at risk of falling into poverty, according to a study by the Federal Statistical Office and published by the German media group Funke. The poverty risk rate for people over 65 increased from 14.7% to 17.4% between 2018 and 2021. Nearly 1 in 6 people over 65 in Germany is at risk of poverty, meaning they have less than 60% of the median income at their disposal. The study was cited in the report. According to the finding, elderly women are more likely to be at risk of poverty. The poverty risk rate for women over 65 was 19.3%, while for men it was 15.1%. In response to the findings, the left-wing faction of the Bundestag demanded government intervention. The Chancellor's stable pensions are a fairy tale. Poverty in old age is exploding, Parliamentary Group Leader Dietmar Bartsch told the Funke newspaper. He reiterated his party's demand for a minimum pension of 1,200 euros and warned that soaring energy prices this winter may leave many more elderly Germans destitute. Germany has been grappling with record high inflation, which accelerated to 8.8% in August, the highest level in nearly 50 years. Energy prices were up 35.6% year-on-year despite their relief measures, while food prices soared by 16.6%. Thank you. RT also reported thousands of Italian firms are on the brink of closure. Small and medium-sized businesses can't cope with soaring energy bills, Corriere della Sera reports. Over 100,000 businesses in Italy are in danger of closing down due to soaring energy bills, the news outlet Corriere della Sera reported recently, citing Carlo Sangalli, head of the Italian Business Association, Confaccio Merioso. Already today, many companies are reorganizing or reducing services. Between now and the first half of 2023, at least 120,000 small businesses in the service sector are at risk. This is a cautious estimate that does not take into account the largest companies, Sangalli told the news outlet. According to the official, the situation could lead to the loss of more than 370,000 jobs. Sangalli noted that energy prices in Italy are much higher than in other countries, which puts a strain on small and medium-sized businesses. Sangalli said, in terms of energy cost, our hotels, restaurants, and stores will pay 40 to 60% more on their bills this year than in Germany and three times that than in France. He noted that the energy crisis may deal the final blow to many businesses that have already been made vulnerable by the COVID-19 pandemic. The official said the country needed good reforms and good investments that will make country work better and in a simpler way, and called for some supportive measures introduced during the pandemic to be reinstated. Italy, along with other EU countries, has been battling record high inflation. Annual inflation in the country reached 8.4% in August, driven largely by energy costs. Italy relies on imports for nearly 75% of its energy. At the start of this year, it was importing 40% of its gas from Russia, but in July, its Russian purchases dropped to 25% due to sanctions. Earlier this month, Italy lost much of its supplies from Russia when Gazprom halted flows via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline due to technical issues. According to a recent survey, over 70% of Italians are having difficulty or are simply unable to pay their energy bills. 9 out of 10 plan to cut spending in order to pay for energy, which they intend to do by curtailing going to restaurants on holidays and buying clothes.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us once again on this special episode of Muslim Lady. As always, I have the honor and privilege of being joined in the studio with my darling sister and expert, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
I always get so excited whenever we are supposed to have discussions. I hope our listeners half as excited as I am about the things that we talk about, especially this episode, because the topic might seem repetitive, but the essence of it is something that we obviously cannot talk about enough. We are dedicating this episode of Muslim Lady to the topic of hijab. Before you guys roll your eyes and say, oh my God, hijab again, how much more are you going to talk about it? We're going to keep talking about it until it's no longer an issue in society, whether the Muslim society or the non-Muslim societies, for as long as non-Muslims view hijab as some sort of alien object on a woman's head and hallmark of the oppression, quote unquote, the Muslim lady faces, we definitely need to still talk about it.
This topic, even when you're looking at it from a fiqhi perspective, jurisprudential perspective, if you want to look at it from fashion, you know, perspective, if you want to look at it from socio-political, whatever perspective, there's always something new to say about it because we're constantly changing. Time is changing. Our conditions and circumstances in life is constantly changing. So it's totally something new. It's a brand new topic to discuss.
Exactly.
Every time from a new perspective, from a new understanding.
And it's evolved so much since the verses regarding hijab first were revealed to Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Fast forward 1400 years, and it's developed so many styles and colors, and sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. Sometimes it's been remodified to suit the modern woman. Mm-hmm. In certain aspects, I think that's totally great. It's cool. It's wonderful. Make it practical. Why not? Islam is a practical religion. And sometimes they just take it overboard, I think, you know, with trying to remodify the hijab and make it like, especially the influencers.
Yeah. I was listening to this lady's talk show, and she was talking about how European investors can, you know, invest like their companies or their brands on having like new hijabi fashions, because a large number of women in the West are hijabi, or a lot of them who are not even observing the hijab, they like hijabi style clothing. Mm. So it's actually financially talking about it. I mean, from the economic perspective, there's so much to say about it, but that's not our topic for today. Mm-hmm. I was going through the words of Ayatollah Khamenei with regards to women. And even today, when you go to the West, like a couple of days ago, I was talking to my sister who is in Sweden, and she was like, "When this old lady was telling me, why do you have this thing on? I mean, what is the purpose of it?" Like, even to this date, there are people who question you and they have no idea as to why you're covering your hair and you're like wearing loose sitting
clothes.
It's
so unfamiliar for them.
So unfamiliar to them, despite the fact that like you just Google up hijab and like you get tons of sites and websites that tell you about everything about hijab.
And it's funny how like, well, Sweden isn't necessarily a very religious country, but for Western people who, well, most of them, even if they're not practicing, they're Christians nonetheless. And they're familiar with the Christian traditions and customs, and they've seen nuns.
Exactly.
Why is it still so weird to them?
You know, like Sweden, especially the city that my sister lives in, it's Malmo. Mm-hmm. And Malmo is a very multicultural city.
Ah.
It's like you see like tons of Muslims, African Muslims, Iraqi Muslims, Afghan Muslims, Iranians. And they're like, it's like you it's impossible. Like my other friend in Canada, Montreal, I was following her on Instagram, and she had like some stories where she said, "I'm going to the cinema, to the movies." And they were like, out of the 10 people present, 7 of them were Muslim women covered with hijab.
Oh, my goodness.
So like hijab is so prevalent in the West that East or West, wherever you're talking about, it's like everyone have seen, like it's impossible to go out in the street and not to see like
at least 1, 2, 3 cases.
At every minute that you're walking by, right? But still, they think that if they see a nun who is well covered in black, you know, from head to toe, that is totally modest and to be respected. But if you see the same woman, a Muslim woman, in black or whatever color, then they say, this is oppression. You're being belittled.
We should liberate her.
Yeah, you should be liberated. Your husband is forcing this on you. Your culture is doing this. Stop oppression against women, this and that.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady here on IRB English Radio. We'll be back after a short break.
This is is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
I am joined by Sister Razia Shamili, and on today's episode, we're talking about hijab. So you were saying, it's cool when nuns do it, when Muslim women do it, y'all are
oppressive. Yeah. Like, you know, like, how do you work? They even stop women to go to work, you know.
That is so weird.
Like, and it's interesting, Zainab, that a lot of men who do like to look at non-hijabis, like with makeup and like
dolled up.
Dolled up and like who have like, you know,
showcase themselves.
Yeah, showcase themselves in the streets. But once they want to get married, they choose modest hijabi women because they want security in life. They want to be sure that the lady they're with is someone that is not going to be with other men, who's not going to look at other men, that they can, you know, put their next generation into the womb of a pure, godly person, right?
Like, even if you look at it from a non-Islamic perspective, even non-Muslim men, they'd rather, like, they might date many, many immodest women. There's a word for it that I don't want to use. But once it comes to settling down, they want to choose a woman who has priorities and integrity.
Exactly.
I mean, to a certain degree, it's literally like in our genes to want that. It's that, evolution.
That's modesty. That,
yeah.
And it's not just like when you're talking about concept of hijab for women, you also have it like for men in their own ways. And the same way that a man likes to marry a hijabi girl, a hijabi woman who he can have a degree of confidence.
Are you keen on using the word hijabi, though? Would you rather use hijabi or modest?
What I mean by hijab is like, you know, a real true hijabi woman, a one who really believes in hijab from deep within. And with the hijab, hijab is just the manifestation of her modesty, of her haya, of her iffa, right?
Right.
Her chastity, that she, like, there is this protection, the sense of protection of, you know, protecting that gem in herself, that thing that she only chooses whom to show, right? Certain people in her life that she chooses to show to and preserves her whole beauty for, right?
Yeah.
In the same way, a woman, a modest, pious, hijabi woman, would choose a man who has true sense of chastity, and also he has a hijab of the heart. Right? So it's like a two-sided thing.
Absolutely. And
because at the end of the day, like, you will have some, like, short fun times. If you want to, like, as I said, settle down for good and have, like, peace of mind and know that this guy is going to stay loyal to you and you're going to have a nice life together, you have to get someone who's truly pious and who fears God. Thing is that, like, the new generation, especially the ones, it doesn't really matter in the East or in the West, many girls, they have been brought up in a way and in certain conditions where they do not have the tendency, or they don't like to really be hijabi. They don't like to observe the hijab. And this is something that is very sad, because, like, I remember myself, I was 9 when I moved to Canada.
Right? Oof.
Like, you know, like at just the time where
that
you
transition
went,
moment.
Yeah, from very childhood to teenagehood, right?
Yep.
And I remember that never ever did my mom or my dad tell me that you have to wear your scarf, or you have to, like, wear your manto, or your, you know, your hijab this way or that way. Never even once, Zainab.
For
I was
real?
Told how to dress up. Ever.
Now, how did you pick it up?
You know, I was born in Iran and I was raised in Qom. Maybe like I picked it up from my mom, or like the school that I went to, my friends, my relatives, the people that I you know grew up with were good Muslims, and I
that's so important.
Like I really didn't have a good philosophical foundation, a good logical foundation for wearing the hijab, but it was something that I wanted to do.
It was ingrained in you.
Ingrained in me. And then later on, I even went to high school there, and I was at one point in my life, I was the
only... Did you go to a public school?
Yeah, I did go to a public school. And I was the only Muslim hijabi girl in that public school. Like, imagine.
Oh my goodness. How many years ago was this? Like 20 years?
Yeah, that was like 20 years ago. You can guess my age.
She's very young. You guys, she's so young.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then I remember like my parents were not there in school. Like people, a lot of parents who have concern for their young girls to wear the hijab, you know, also have the concern that they don't even like to pray. Mm. So it's like, you know, the generation whose concern, you know, that you have this concern for to wear the hijab and to pray, you know, it's like it means that something is missing within themselves, within their identity, within their personality, that the because hijab and prayers are just the branches or they're just the leaves of the tree of faith. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So the trunk of the tree and the roots of the tree, there's something, the reason that you have problem with your girl's hijab or praying has to do in either the trunk or the roots of the tree, right? This lady I was reading an article from, she was saying that when Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh, at the time of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he was successful in assisting and to leading a large population of the youth of not only Iran, of, you know, youth around the world, to fight oppression, right? Mm-hmm. So what was the motive? The same motive, you can find it in the hijab of, you know, youth in this age, in this generation. And that is the feeling or the urge to fight for something.
That's beautiful.
That was very nice. And I was like, oh, I never thought of it. I never looked at it from this perspective. That was like really nice.
Thank you, Sister Razia. Just a quick recap of what we've been discussing. It was the topic of hijab, the importance of understanding the essence of hijab as a form of self-discipline and a value to fight for, to wake up for in the morning and to strive toward. Until another episode, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In a recent statement, the United Nations agencies and the Association of International Development Agencies, AIDA, working in the occupied Palestinian territories, called on the Israeli regime to allow Palestinian human rights and humanitarian organizations to continue their work. We now present you an article written by Isaac Scher. The piece is titled CIA Unable to Corroborate Israel's Terror Label for Palestinian Rights Groups. A classified CIA report shows the agency was unable to find any evidence to support the Israeli regime's decision to label six prominent Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations. In October, the Zionist regime labeled as terror groups Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, Dal Haq, the Bissan Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children International Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. The Israeli regime claimed that the organizations were front groups for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, a Palestinian political party and resistance group that has a paramilitary branch. According to two sources familiar with the study, earlier this year, Israeli regime passed intelligence about the designation to the United States, but a CIA intelligence assessment of the material did not find any evidence to support the claim. A second source said the assessment was highly classified. Numerous states, including allies of the Israeli regime, have rejected the terror designation as unfounded. The United States has not publicly criticized or questioned it, but neither has it placed the Palestinian groups under a U.S. terror designation. Omar Shaker, the Israel-Palestine Director of Human Rights Watch, said, in light of the CIA's assessment, the United States should very clearly call on the Israeli regime to reverse these designations and to allow these organizations to continue with their vital work. Omar Shaker added, "The reality here is that the United States has far too long turned a blind eye and in some cases even green-lighted quite serious Israeli government abuses." He added, "The position towards the Palestinian human rights organizations highlights a much larger failing in U.S. government policy on the Israeli-Palestinian issue and puts the United States squarely out of touch with the consensus in the human rights movement." Since announcing the designation, the Zionist regime has continued its effort to stop the six non-governmental organizations, NGOs, from continuing their advocacy work. On Thursday, 18th of August, the Israeli military raided the West Bank offices of all six groups, confiscating property, sealing off office doors, and posting official notices declaring the groups illegal. After the raids, the State Department spokesperson Ned Price confirmed that the U.S. government has analyzed Israel's evidence for the terror charge. Ned Price said, "What happened last year is the Israeli cabinet designated these organizations, claiming we have not followed through with any designations, nor have we changed our approach to these organizations." Ned Price declined to comment on the CIA report and referred The Guardian to the CIA. The CIA did not respond to The Guardian's questions. The classified assessment mirrors the findings of European governments that were also shown dossiers of Israeli evidence. Last month, nine member states of the European Union said in a joint statement, "No substantial information was received from Israel that would justify reviewing our policy towards the six Palestinian non-governmental organizations." According to political analysts, the designation was intended in part to dry up the purported European funding streams to the Palestinian non-governmental organizations, NGOs. But the tactic has proved unsuccessful. According to Lara Friedman, the president of the Foundation for West Asia Peace, the US government's public stance is a mixed one. Lara Friedman said, "A lot of us would have liked to see an affirmative rebuttal of the designations," adding, "They didn't do that, but there's been nothing undertaken by this administration that would suggest they're viewing these organizations as terrorist organizations." But she added, "The US administration has had 10 months to convince Israel to reverse the designations. Instead, this is now Israeli law." A handful of the US legislators have publicly criticized the Israeli regime's terror designation. Recently, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley and 21 other Democrats sent a letter to Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and Avril Haines, the Director of National Intelligence, urging the US government to stand up to the Israeli regime. The lawmakers wrote, "A reported lack of evidence to support this decision raises concerns that it may be a deeply repressive measure designed to criminalize and silence prominent and essential Palestinian human rights organizations." According to a claim by the federal government source, Antony Blinken has shied away from the issue of the designations since Israel announced them. The US Secretary of State himself said basically, "This isn't something we want to touch too much." The source claimed, "Most letters written to the Secretary of State don't make it to his desk verbatim in full." Beyond lawmakers' public effort to address the issue, there have been private challenges to the Israeli designation. Last year, an Israeli delegation provided a similar dossier and briefing to members of Congress. That dossier, seen by The Guardian, repeats claims that the groups are cover institutions for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. But a congressional source said at the briefing, there was dismay at the quality of the dossier's evidence. Among skeptics was the Florida Democratic Congressman Ted Deutch, who has described himself as a passionate supporter of Israel. The source said after receiving the dossier, Ted Deutch told the Israeli delegation its evidence was insufficient. Deutsch's office did not respond to a request for comment. Furthermore, in a recent statement, the United Nations agencies and the Association of International Development Agencies, AIDA, working in the occupied Palestinian territories, called on the Israeli regime to allow Palestinian human rights and humanitarian organizations to continue with their work. The United Nations agencies and the Association of International Development Agencies, AIDA, said the attempted closure of these organization offices represents the latest in a series of actions by Israeli regime that limit the ability of human rights, humanitarian and development work in the occupied Palestinian territories and affect all institutions working to promote human rights and development. The statement said, "We urge Israel to refrain from any action that would prevent these organizations from continuing their critical human rights, humanitarian and developmental work in the occupied Palestinian territories." The United Nations agencies and the Association of International Development Agencies, AIDA, stressed that the Israeli authorities had provided no compelling evidence to justify the terrorist label that they had put on the Palestinian organizations. In a press statement cited by Palestine's official Wafa news agency on Thursday, 18th of August, Amnesty International called for an end to the stifling of Palestinian civil society organizations at the hands of Israeli occupation authorities. Amna Gwelali, Amnesty International's Deputy Director for West Asia and North Africa, said, The Israeli occupation authorities must end their campaign of repression against Palestinian civil society and let organizations carry out their work free from harassment, urging all governments to condemn the Israeli army's attack on Palestinian civil society. Amna Gwelali added, "These organizations have contributed enormously to human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories and across the globe, yet Israeli army boots trample all over their work." She said the international community needs to work together, not only to reopen the offices of these seven organizations, but also to honor their calls to support the International Criminal Court's, the ICC's investigation into the Palestinian situation and for international condemnation of Israel's apartheid against Palestinians. Also, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs strongly censured Israel's unlawful military raid on the offices of Palestinian human rights organizations and civil society organizations in Ramallah and in Al-Bira. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs in a statement said, "The Israeli occupation forces looted documents, seized equipment and sealed off offices in another clear attempt to repress and intimidate those documenting and pursuing accountability for Israeli crimes." It warned, "As Israel's illegal occupation and apartheid regime becomes further entrenched, Palestinian civil society and human rights defenders will continue to be among the prime targets as they play a key role in monitoring and documenting Israel's crimes and violations against the Palestinian people." The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs further said, "Documentation, advocacy, humanitarian aid and legal work are the hallmarks of democracy and essential for the protection of human rights worldwide." The statement added, "The work of human rights defenders must be protected." The statement said, "Absence of political will to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its decades of crimes and violations enables its continued war against international human rights movements."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.